a day on against the grain. Hundreds of millions of people have moved from China's countryside into urban areas. Have the working class migrants who've built China's megacities been rewarded for their efforts? I'm CS. Eli Friedman describes the obstacles and injustices they've encountered coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. It's been called the largest mass migration in human history. It is the movement of Chinese people from rural areas to China's cities to work in construction, manufacturing, and other industries. We're talking about the migration of about 300 million people, people who hoped to make a living and enjoy the benefits of residing in cities like Beijing, Shanghai, and Guangzhou. So what happened to them? How were and are they treated? What social services can they access? What sort of education are they able to get for their children? Eli Friedman takes up these pressing issues in his new book, The Urbanization of People: The Politics of Development, Labor Markets, and Schooling in the Chinese City. Eli Friedman is Associate Professor of International and Comparative Labor at Cornell University's School of Industrial and Labor Relations. When Eli and I connected recently, he began by describing how migration and work operated in mid-20th century China.
After the revolution in 1949, the government went about establishing what they call the household registration system, or the hukou. That's something that I've studied a lot, and I'll certainly have more to say about. But what it does is it kind of pinned people in place, and so your access to social services became located in a particular place in the country, and it was very, very difficult to move that household registration from one place to another. So you couldn't be someone living in the countryside in China in the 1960s or 1970s and decide, hey, I want to move to Beijing, and so I'm gonna pick up the family and move. And so there's some studies that compare China, you know, not only to American capitalist countries, but even compared to the Soviet Union. If you look at mobility, it was much lower in China than it was even in these other state socialist countries. So there was very, very little movement that was happening at all during the 1950s, 60s, and 1970s. And what you have beginning in the 1980s, once Deng Xiaoping comes to power, he establishes these special economic zones, he legitimizes private enterprise, and so you have foreign investment that's coming in, setting up factories that are producing goods that are largely going to be destined for the United States, for Europe, and for other wealthy economies. And in order for these factories to work, they need workers. And so the government identifies as their key comparative advantage in this development strategy, China's large, relatively healthy and well-educated workforce, and a workforce that, of course, is also quite inexpensive in the 1980s. And so they begin to develop these kinds of administrative arrangements that allow people to at least temporarily leave their place of household registration to move to the cities for work. And again, that's really kind of the social basis of that whole model of economic development.
What kinds of jobs in the cities were made possible by this economic expansion? What were, let's say, the majority of rural folks who were moving to Chinese cities at this time in the late 1900s and early 2000s, what were they enlisted to do there?
So there's been a real evolution over the last 40 years. And initially, the special economic zones were set up in the southeastern part of the country. And again, they were very focused on this export-oriented form of production. So factories were the place where people first got lots of employment. And you see a big expansion in employment in manufacturing through the 80s and through the 90s. It actually really begins to slow down by the end of the first decade of the 21st century. And you begin to see much more diversification in terms of the kinds of employment that rural migrants are ending up in when they get into the city. One big area that's absorbed a huge amount of this rural labor is in construction. So if you've been to Chinese cities anytime in the last 20 years, you can see that just these massive megacities have kind of sprouted up overnight, the clearest example being in Shenzhen. But other cities, Beijing, Shanghai, et cetera, have all grown really, really quickly. So you need people to build the buildings. China has spent a huge amount of money developing a really world-class infrastructure system. So they now have far and away the largest high-speed rail network anywhere in the world. They have port facilities and airport facilities that are much more advanced and much larger than anything we have in the United States. All of these things need to be built, right? And so construction has also absorbed a lot. But one of the interesting things as we move closer to the contemporary period is we quickly see that the service sector absorbs more and more of these workers. So we have people who are going to work in food and beverage and hospitality. We have people who are doing sanitation work, domestic workers, reproductive labor of all sorts, cooks, nannies. These are developing quite quickly.
You write that poor migrants from the countryside in China tend to be funneled when they get to the cities into informal labor. What do you mean by informal labor?
There's a lot of different ways that people think about informal labor. This is something that labor scholars have studied in lots of different places around the world, particularly in the Global South, going back all the way to the 1970s. One of the ways to think about informal labor are forms of work that in certain contexts might be regulated, but happen to not be regulated by the state, by laws. They don't receive social protections, right? So, you know, you go home and you cook dinner. That's a form of work, but it's not a form of work that tends to be regulated by the state. You go into a restaurant and you work as a cook. That's a different kind of a labor, and that does tend to be regulated by the state. So informality in China is a little bit difficult to pin down for a whole variety of reasons. There's definitely not good official statistics on this. But the kinds of labor that are more typically associated with informal labor, which is things like recyclers on the street, you know, people who are kind of going through materials that are left, scrap materials, and trying to salvage some of it. That's kind of a classic example. You have street hawkers, people who are selling food on the street in kind of a legal gray zone. But we also have a huge number of workers that seem like they should be regulated by the state. So factory workers are a classic example. When the literature and the research on informal labor was developing in the 1970s, oftentimes the foil or the assumed point of comparison was this industrial workforce in the global north, which had legal labor contracts, they had various kinds of social protections, oftentimes had unions, and people were pointing to the fact that there's all this other kinds of labor that you know, that doesn't enjoy those kinds of protections. Well, if we look at China, a huge amount of labor in these formal seeming factories, these factories that certainly are regulated in some ways by the state, labor itself is actually unregulated. So you'll have people that are working in factories for a long time, they never have a labor contract. You have huge swaths, in some cases up to half of the workforce, that are these temporary or dispatch workers that are not directly employed by the factory and do not enjoy any kinds of social protections. So it's very difficult to get a precise estimate on the scope of informality, but the salient point here is that for a huge number, possibly a majority of the workers that are coming to Chinese cities, they don't enjoy any legal protections. I should say within construction, which is absorbs, as I've just said, quite a lot of that labor, it's quite exceptional to have a labor contract. Very, very few of these workers enjoy labor contracts.
Eli Friedman joins me on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. He is associate professor and chair of international and comparative labor at Cornell University's ILR School. His new book is The Urbanization of People: The Politics of Development, Labor Markets, and Schooling in the Chinese City. Where did the millions of workers from the countryside who came to the cities, who arrived in the cities to work in construction and manufacturing and some of the other industries that you mentioned, where did they generally, and you know, these are low-paying jobs, as you're mentioning, many of them informal, where did they find places to live?
The housing question for migrant workers is really important because it has all kinds of implications for their experience in the city and also for their ability to access other kinds of social services. And it's really uneven. It depends a lot on the kind of work that you end up doing. So if we look at the export processing zones, which are quite prominent in Guangdong province, in the Pearl River Delta area, and in the Yangtze River Delta area around Shanghai, it's quite common for those factories to have on-site dormitories. So there's a factory complex, it's generally walled. Within that, you'll have both the production facilities and dormitories. Now, these were built under the assumption that the workforce was going to be overwhelmingly young and single. And so for many years, you had this people would come in as teenagers, they would stay for a few years, and by the time they got to their mid-20s, the assumption was they would go back to the village and they would settle down there to get married and have kids. That has changed somewhat. The workforce has certainly aged, and so they've had to adjust that somewhat, and we do see an increasing number of factory workers who are living outside the grounds of the facility. So that's one possibility. When we think about construction workers, they're usually quite mobile and are moving around the city. And so it's quite common on, at least on large construction sites, and most construction sites in China are quite large, certainly by American standards. They will build these kind of temporary houses, basically trailers, and workers will be housed on site there as well. But then you have all of the other workers, and they're in a diversity of workplaces. If you're working as a waiter in a restaurant, the chances that employer is going to provide housing are quite small. If you're a street sweeper, if you're a food delivery worker, if you're a security guard, if you're a nanny, you know, these workers generally need to find housing on their own. And given the cost of housing, particularly in China's megacities, which is absolutely exorbitant. If you look at the income to housing cost ratio in China's largest cities in places like Beijing, Shanghai, Shenzhen, and Guangzhou, and you compare it to American cities, it's much, much worse in the large Chinese cities than it is in San Francisco, in New York, in London, in Tokyo. And so there's a real housing crisis for the working class in Chinese megacities. So just going out and buying a house on the market is beyond the means of these working class migrants. Rentals can also be very difficult. And so what they end up doing is living largely in informal housing. Different cities have different kinds of arrangements. It really depends on the geography, on urban planning, which is different city to city. But it's quite common for people to live in these kind of self-built units that locals have built that exist in kind of a legal gray zone. There's oftentimes substandard conditions, poor heating, electrical problems. There have been issues with ventilation. There have been fires that have tragically taken people's lives. They're typically on the peripheral part of the city. And so oftentimes commuting to work can be a real challenge. It's not unusual in a city like Beijing for people to spend, more than 3 hours commuting a day. In other cases, in Beijing, it's also quite common for people to live in these informal, not regulated basement apartments. And so they won't have any windows or obviously access to sunlight. So there's a whole diversity of possibilities, but the short answer is, if you're in these cities as a migrant worker, there's a very good chance that you'll be living in some kind of informal housing.
Now, as your book indicates, by the early 2010s, obstacles to human movement into Chinese cities remained formidable. That's interesting because, as you were saying, the government's interest is getting people from the countryside into cities so that they could do the labor that's required to build China, to build the buildings, to do the work involved in manufacturing and service industries. So why was human mobility into the city so difficult until fairly recently? And what did at least the Chinese national government decide to try to do?
The way I think about this is that the key social contradiction in China's whole development model is that they have gone about over the last 40 years constructing a national labor market, which is to say that people are free to move about the country and to enjoy the very thin freedom of selling their labor anywhere. So you have a national labor market, but social citizenship, meaning access to social services like healthcare, education, subsidized housing, etc., is structured at the level of the city, right? And so that presents a real challenge from the perspective of workers. Now, for cities, this has been a great deal, and it really is key to explaining the economic success of some of these fabulously wealthy cities. And the reason for that is because all of the costs associated with the social reproduction of that worker, their formation, their education, their healthcare as young people, is born in the countryside. And they show up fully formed, ready to work, and the city hasn't had to contribute anything to the formation of that worker. And then when that worker is too old, or that worker becomes sick, then they can leave and they go back to the countryside, and all of those additional costs are then have to be borne by the countryside as well. So cities really just get to have had this situation where they just get to enjoy the kind of the prime years of these workers' lives without having to pay any of the costs associated. Now, obviously, it's not been a very good deal for the countryside. So that was kind of how things worked in the 90s and into the 2000s. But what we saw as the 2000s progressed is actually a labor shortage. And this was kind of puzzling to a lot of people when it first began to show up in the mid-2000s, because, you know, here's China, the largest country on earth with 1.4 billion people. And many people assumed that there would be this, you know, nearly endless supply of rural labor. And actually, it dried up pretty quickly because people had a very difficult time settling down in the cities, and so they had to leave. And so the government has made a pretty decisive shift. It was clearly marked in 2014, where for the first time in the history of the People's Republic of China, they actually encouraged people to move to the cities. Going back all the way to the 1950s with the implementation of this household registration system, they've really been trying to prevent rural people from moving to the cities, or at least moving to the cities and settle down, right? From the 1980s on, you could move to the city to work, but then you had to leave. And so from 2014, they're saying, well, we actually do want people to move to the cities. For a variety of reasons, they think that they believed that it would help them increase their domestic consumption, which is to say, rather than producing things and selling them to the United States or Europe or whatever, that Chinese people themselves could be these kind of modern urban consumers, and that they would just buy the stuff that's being produced in China, and so they'd be less dependent on these foreign markets. And so they really wanted urbanization to be driving economic growth. There is an important caveat, though, and this is really important in my book, which is that they want people to move to cities, but they don't want people to move to the very largest cities. And so what you see is that the smaller the city is, the easier it is for rural people to relocate there and to permanently settle down. The larger the city is, the harder it is, and the more restrictions that there are, and some pretty significant implications follow from that.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Eli Friedman joins me. He teaches international and comparative labor at Cornell University. He's written a book called Insurgency Trap: Labor Politics in Post-Socialist China. We are talking about his new book out from Columbia University Press. It's called The Urbanization of People, The Politics of Development, Labor Markets, and Schooling in the Chinese City. So why didn't the Chinese national government, why didn't they want people to move to the larger cities, the mega cities, the cities that presumably needed quite a bit of labor because it had a lot of industry?
The largest cities do need a lot of labor. And the truth of the matter is that they cannot function without migrant labor. All of these workers that I just talked about make the city run. But there's a consideration. There's a couple considerations. The first is, I think, a deeply ingrained political logic in the Chinese state, which associates overpopulation with political instability. A colleague of mine, Jeremy Wallace, who teaches here at Cornell, has written a whole book about this. The leaders of the Communist Party looked at some other cities in the global south, saw these slums that emerge in places in India and Southeast Asia, Africa and Latin America, and associate those with political radicalism, right, with crime, these things that they really want to avoid. But the idea that there's this one-to-one relationship between migrants coming in and political instability is also really problematic, because it leads to all kinds of repressive actions against the migrants themselves. So there's the political logic, and I should say that in the city of Beijing as the capital, that political logic of this fear of overpopulation is very intense. There's a second part to this, and it's one that I focus on more in my book, which is thinking about the developmental aims of these megacities. So places like Beijing and Shanghai imagine themselves as these global cities that are locked in intense competition with other global cities, places like New York and London and Singapore, that they're locked in this intense competition in various high value added industries. So thinking about finance, thinking about tech, entertainment, even education to some extent, and to some extent also high value added forms of manufacturing. And so they want to be able to, and this is very clear if you look at the official documents that lay out these strategies, they want to be able to pull in specifically the kinds of workers that will allow that city to be more globally competitive in these very high-end industries. And so what they're doing is they're actually not shutting off in-migration altogether, right? They're not kind of closing down the circulation of people into the city. What they're trying to do is bring in these very specific kinds of workers. So if you have an advanced degree from a prestigious university in finance, right? Not only are you not going to be excluded, there are policies to facilitate you moving into the city. And this is true in Beijing and Shanghai and elsewhere. On the other hand, if you are a construction worker, if you are a street cleaner, or if you're a hawker, the city doesn't value that labor. That labor does not fit into their plan for economic upgrading. And therefore, the kinds of policies that they have adopted are quite harsh with respect to these kinds of workers.
And I think much of what you're talking about relates to hukou admission. So hukou is this household registration that you were talking about that used to tie somebody to the area in which they had hukou. So you have people with rural hukou, and if they go into the cities, they want urban hukou, so they sort of gain thereby a right to live in the cities and presumably, and you can tell me more about this, have access to social services like, for example, education and healthcare. So the criteria, is it fair to say the criteria for hukou admission to the cities are restrictive? And the government has an interest and has been pursuing this interest in only giving certain workers the sort of imprimatur of a legitimacy that comes with having hukou in the cities. And also, I want to ask that you don't have to have hukou to live in a city, right? But you certainly want it in order to gain the benefits of living in a city.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. You do want hukou. One way to think about hukou is it is the thing that guarantees you social citizenship. So all of the things that people need to live a decent and dignified life, including access to public education, access to healthcare, access to subsidized housing to the extent that it exists, pensions, et cetera. Those, you do not have guaranteed access to any of those things unless you have hukou in the place that you're living. So you can move to Beijing. Like I said, China has a national labor market. They have, in a certain sense, they have freedom of mobility. You won't be rounded up off the streets and kind of deported back to your countryside, which was the case actually prior to 2003, but at least for the last 20 years or so, police are no longer deporting rural migrants. But what it means is that you're going to be entirely dependent on the market for securing all of those things that you need to survive. So if you have fabulously high wages, that's fine. You don't need to worry about getting your child into a public school. You can send your kid to a prep school. And there's a lot of people who are non-Beijing hukou people who actually do make a lot of money. For working class people, of course, it poses a real problem because the kind of education that they can buy, and this is, I focus on this a lot in the book, is of course not very good. And if you're sending your child to a school that receives zero subsidies from the state, which is true for a lot of these informal schools for the children of migrant workers, they're just not going to be able to get a very good education, despite some of the heroic efforts on the part of teachers and community members. So you can move to cities without hukou, but it's going to make your life extremely challenging. So to come back to the first question, how is it that you go about getting hukou if you move from outside? This is a highly decentralized system, so every city sets up their own requirements. As I've already indicated, the larger the city, the more difficult it will be to get hukou. The fact that the larger cities are more difficult to get hukou is a real problem from the perspective of inequality, because the larger the city, the better the social services that they have. And this is something that is widely understood within China, that cities like Beijing and Shanghai have the best public schools, they have the best hospitals, they have the most generous social services. And so you can really see how they're using these administrative arrangements to kind of barricade the relative privileges of these high quality public goods. They're not actually public goods because they're not available to the public. So what they've developed in Beijing and other large cities over the last few years is what's called point-based hukou admissions. And this is to some extent similar to the kinds of citizenship requirements that Canada has. I believe Canada was the first country to develop these point-based plans for applying for permanent residency and citizenship. The difference is that Canada, of course, uses it for international immigrants. And in China, they've developed this for the subnational citizenship regime. So people who are citizens of the PRC, but move from a rural area to one of these large cities, they have to accumulate points.
Points. How does one go about accumulating points?
It's a little bit different in different cities. But in general, the kinds of things that will allow you to accumulate points include, first and most importantly, is your level of education. So the more education you have, the more points that you can get. The second thing that is very important in every city is housing. So if you own your own home, then you get more points. If you rent, you get fewer points. If you live in informal housing, you will get no points. And that's true, I think, in every city. Some cities have a more complex arrangement where, you know, depending how much of your mortgage you've paid off, you can accumulate more points. It can get pretty arcane. So housing is also really, really important. Paying into local social insurance. So they want to see that you've been living in the city for a certain number of years. And not only that you've been living there, that you've been paying into the healthcare system, into the pension system, et cetera, and you need documentation of that. So what you can see with all of these is that they disadvantage working class people, right? There's lots of people who would love to be able to have social insurance, but they're informal workers, right? Or they might even have a labor contract and so not be totally informal, but they have an unscrupulous boss who has not been making their contributions to the social insurance program, which is extremely, extremely common. We've already discussed housing and how difficult it is for many migrant workers to live in formal housing. And so if you live in informal housing, you are also just going to be excluded from these point-based HUCO acquisitions as well. And then I think it's pretty straightforward. The more education you have, the easier it is to get these. Well, you know, lots of people would like to have a graduate degree from a prestigious university in Beijing. But if you grew up in a rural part of China, the education system has been severely underfunded over the last 40 years. You know, China has 9 years of compulsory education. Literacy rates are quite high, and China has always performed quite well in terms of education, given its level of development. All that being said, you still do have many millions of people who are undereducated, many people who are still illiterate, and so they're going to be completely excluded from these things. So, you know, the kind of the conclusion that I draw from all of this is that we have this access to social goods, which really benefits the people who need it least, right? It benefits rich people and excludes just about everyone else.
His name is Eli Friedman. He's an associate professor and he's chair of international and comparative labor at Cornell University's ILR School. And his new book is The Urbanization of People, The Politics of Development, Labor Markets, and Schooling in the Chinese City. I'm CS and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So we talked about point-based hukou admission and how difficult that is, given the hoops and the obstacles you have to surmount in order to get local hukou in, especially the large cities, the wealthy cities, and much of your book focuses on Beijing. And more or less in tandem with this point-based hukou schemes are point-based public school enrollment procedures for non-local hukou holders. So in other words, people who have not been successful in getting local hukou where they live and work in the cities. So they want to get their children into public school. And as you indicate in your book, that is the desired goal. You want to get your children into public school and not into what are called, I guess, or at least what you call migrant schools, which are private, but those schools, and if we have time, we'll talk more about them, don't provide the kind of quality education that public schools in places like Beijing do. So point-based school enrollment procedures, I assume then they look at various factors, various criteria, and determine whether you have enough points in order to deserve or merit the granting of the right to have your children go to public school. What points are assigned for what? How difficult is it to gain admission to public school?
The first thing to note about this is that if you fail to move your hukou, your household registration, to the city where you're living, it does not mean that you are excluded from public education. What it means is that you are not guaranteed access to public education. So you have, again, 300 million people who are living outside of their place of household registration. It's this gargantuan population. In some cities, particularly in the Pearl River Delta area in Guangdong Province, you have some cities where there's an absolute majority of the population are non-local. So for those people who will not be able to get hukou, which is the overwhelming majority of these migrants, there's still the possibility that they could get their children into public schools, which, as you said, is what they want to do, right? The public schools are the good ones, and the private schools are the bad ones in Chinese cities, with some exceptions. You have some very, very high-end private schools. Beijing, the city where I did most of my research, does not yet have these point-based school admission policies, but they are much more prevalent in Guangdong province in the south. I also did research in Guangzhou, and I've spent a lot of time living in that area and doing research. My first book was largely based on research in Guangzhou. So what they will do, first of all, it is incredibly complicated because it's not only that every city has its own policy, every district within the city will establish its own requirements for admissions, right? So you might move from one part of the city to another, and you have a totally new set of regulations that you have to deal with. The kinds of things that allow you to accumulate points for school admissions are similar, actually, to the kinds of things that you need for hukou admissions. There's a little bit less emphasis on the parents' level of education, but the parents' level of education can allow you to generate more points. The most important metric has to do with housing and term of residence, payment into local social insurance as well. So just as with the hukou admissions, the school admissions, if you own a house, you're going to accumulate more points. If you rent a house, you'll accumulate fewer points. If you live in informal housing, you'll not be able to accumulate points at all, right? So immediately this eliminates the kind of the lower tiers of the labor market. If you're a working class person, there's a great chance that you're living in informal housing. And that means right from the jump, you won't be able to get your child into public school via these mechanisms. There's different cities have different kinds of particular arrangements that allow you to gain more points or fewer points. One thing that we've seen, which has been particularly troubling for many parents, is some districts have a requirement that you have to live, work, and send your child to school in the same district. So living in the same district, sending your child to school in the same district is normal and is common practice around the world. But a lot of people have to live in a peripheral district because that's the only place that they can afford housing, and they have to work in a central district because that's the place where the jobs are. And so by dint of the fact that they're living in these peripheral places and working somewhere else, they also will not be able to get their child into the public schools. And so here we see yet another layer where we have this access to public goods that's being guarded by these metrics, these methods of assessing the presumed value of the people. And it overwhelmingly benefits the people who are already in the best position.
Part of your book, The Urbanization of People, draws on interviews you did with parents of children enrolled in, I think, primary school in a part of Beijing. And many of these people were working class migrants, perhaps all of them. And they were trying to get their children into public schools, maybe for future grades or future levels of secondary education. What did they tell you about the impact of some of these points-based and other school enrollment procedures on their lives, on the decisions they need to make in relation to their children, in relation to their residents, in relation to their lives?
I was doing fieldwork in Beijing in 2014, and what we saw around that period of time, just after the central government had announced this plan saying that they were encouraging people to move to the cities, what we saw in Beijing was precisely the opposite, that actually the city was taking increasingly coercive steps to remove people from the city. And they had many levers. They were closing down labor-intensive forms of manufacturing. They were relocating big warehouses out of the city. They were demolishing informal housing. They were also making it much more restrictive to get access to public education. So I talked to a lot of parents who had this expectation that they might be able to get their child into school based on the formal rules. Like if you went to the Department of Education and they said, here are the stipulations for non-local people to get your children into public school, they believed that they would be able to get in. And then they found out that the actual practice, practically speaking, there was a invisible set of requirements. So, and those really ramped up in 2014 as the government was trying to make it more and more difficult for people to get their children into schools, with the hopes that not only would the children leave, but that the parents would also leave with them. So just one example. In Beijing at the time, they didn't have these point-based school admissions. They had this five permits system was what it called, where you had to produce a bunch of documentation, including the child's hukou. You had to present a labor contract, a housing deed, etc. People would gather all of the paperwork that the government had told them that they needed, and then they would go back. And then the Department of Education would say, oh no, we actually need you to come up with something else, right? So one of the really common ones was, we need you to demonstrate that you've paid into social insurance. This is not written down anywhere, at the time anyway, it was not written down anywhere, but they began demanding it for public school admissions. And so people would go around and try to work that out. I interviewed one family, and they said that the mother was informally employed, and so she didn't have any hope of being able to provide a documentation for social insurance. The father had been working for an employer. That employer had not been paying their social insurance, as the employer is legally obligated to do. And so you have this, you know, this working class family who had moved from the countryside to Beijing. What they did is they went with the boss, and they themselves were trying to pay into the social insurance plan, the thing that was the boss's responsibility, but he'd failed to do that. They were trying to pay into the social insurance plan so that they could get documentation that would then allow their child to get into school. Another thing that has happened, and I also interviewed parents that told me these stories about their housing, where they were living in informal housing. And so this question of providing a rental agreement. Sometimes you can go in with a kind of shoddy rental agreement, and it's just a document that you and your landlord drew up together, and that would work. But if the education department is feeling like they want to be a little bit more rigorous, then they might demand a kind of a more formalized, legally binding lease, as well as documentation that the landlord had paid taxes on that property, which as informal housing, they probably have not. So I interviewed some parents who said that they went with their landlord to the tax bureau, and they were going to pay the taxes on this informal house for their landlord, so that the tax bureau would then issue the certificate that they had paid taxes, which they could then take back to the Department of Education as proof that they're actually living in this place and that it's a legitimate lease, therefore allowing their child to get into school. And you know, sometimes that would work and sometimes it wouldn't. There's also widespread understanding among migrant parents that even if they do all of the paperwork, even if the Department of Education signs off, that the schools themselves are still not legally obligated to take their children. And every migrant parent that I talked to, that I asked about this, understood that they would have to pay bribes in order to get their children into school. In the mid-2010s, when I started this research, people generally assumed that the bribe that they would have to pay would be between 20,000 and 100,000 yuan. So that could easily be a year's salary for many of these working class migrants at the time. So it's not an insubstantial amount of money. So what the fieldwork allowed me to do was to look at, you know, what are the policies as written down, and then how are they actually put into practice. And we can see when they are put into practice that all of these additional obstacles can appear.
You are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. Eli Friedman teaches international and comparative labor at Cornell University, and we are talking about his new book. It's called The Urbanization of People: The Politics of Development, Labor Markets, and Schooling in the Chinese City. It's published by Columbia University Press. On againstthegrain.org, we have a link to Eli's faculty page at Cornell's ILR school as well as to his new book. Well, given the fact that these children of working class migrants in many cities in China are largely excluded from public education in the cities, what do the parents do with them?
The most popular choice is for families to just be split up, right? So there are tens of millions of so-called left behind children in China. Those refer to the children who are living either without one or either of their parents back in the village, and they're being raised by extended family or by grandparents, and they just go to public school in the village and you know, only see their parents maybe once a year, sometimes not even that. So there's obvious psychological and developmental effects on children from not seeing their parents.
So this must be an emotionally wrenching situation for parents, as you're suggesting, not feeling like they're able to move back to their hometowns, to their home villages with their children who need an education, and that's really the best situation for the children at the time. For these families to be split up and separated, I imagine often over long distances.
It's an unbelievably difficult situation. The combination of this national labor market, which really compels people to move to cities to find jobs in order to support their family, with this very fractured access to education system that they have, has really eviscerated the rural family. I mean, there's a whole generation that has grown up that has just not been able to enjoy the basic human right of living with their family. And it creates just endless challenging, impossible decisions for parents and for families. So if you're, China's a big country, it's diverse, right? But in many places, you cannot survive staying in the countryside. There are just not adequate economic opportunities. There are not adequate jobs in order for you to support your family. So you have to move to the cities. Once you've made that decision, then the question is, do you bring your child with you or not? And bringing your child with you to, you know, enjoy all of the joys of seeing your child grow up means that you might be forsaking that child's very future, right? Because they can't have access to decent public schooling. Or you can leave them in the countryside where they will have access to public schools. They're not nearly as good as the public schools in the city, and so the child's future is still maybe not particularly bright. But there's research that shows that on average, from a purely educational outcome standpoint, you're better off leaving your child in the countryside. And then you're in the city working to support that child, but you never get to see them.
Well, Eli, we've been talking about actually just two chapters of your book, The Urbanization of People. What else is addressed in your book, in this book?
The book deals with a number of issues. I begin with this overview of the policy, and I just look at what the government says it's doing in terms of its urbanization policy, in terms of urban development, and in terms of education, and thinking about how these all fit together. The bulk of the book is then turning to ethnographic and interview-based research to look at the effects of state policy, how it impacts people's daily lives, how it impacts the location, as well as the demolition and the relocation of these schools. One piece, we've talked quite a bit about these various administrative arrangements that kind of apply this pressure on rural families to leave the cities. Those are extremely important in sifting people away, getting them to move to smaller cities or back to the countryside. But I also spend some time looking at some of the more coercive efforts, and there have been a huge number of school demolitions that have taken place in Beijing and other large cities over the last couple of decades, where in the process of urban redevelopment, the land comes to be more valued for its market value, and they want to build high rises, they want to build a mall or what have you, and these informal schools for migrant children are just not valued by the city, so they just show up with a bulldozer. And so I detail the consequences of these demolitions and what it means for families when they are ejected from schools kind of without much notice. I also spend, I have an entire chapter that looks at the labor conditions for the teachers. I'm trained as a labor scholar, and that's actually how I got into this project. I'm not trained in urban studies or in education studies. So one of the things that really struck me when I first got to these schools was just how abysmal the working conditions were for the teachers. These are, again, totally informal, privatized schools. Some of them are run pretty ruthlessly as businesses. And so the boss, they don't refer to the principal, they refer to the boss, is constantly trying to get the teachers to work longer hours, to take on more tasks. The teachers in Beijing are typically being paid well below minimum wage. They don't have labor contracts themselves, so their labor is totally informal. And you have these folks who are incredibly dedicated to the kind of the social mission of educating people who would otherwise be completely excluded, but they simply don't have the conditions to flourish and to allow their students to flourish. And then I conclude with a comparative and a global extension of the research and really thinking about this question about how human movement is managed in relationship to processes of capitalist development. And I look at Beijing in comparison to some other cities, both the comparison and relationally, because if you'll recall, I think of Beijing as being at the top of this apex that funnels all of these resources to the top. But since the government is interested in having people move to smaller cities, I also investigated some of those. And the problems there are different, but they're not without problems. It may be easier to get into public schools in some of those smaller cities, but those schools are severely under-resourced. And so it's not necessarily a better deal for those children.
The book is The Urbanization of People: The Politics of Development, Labor Markets, and Schooling in the Chinese City. The author, my guest, is Eli Friedman. He's Associate Professor of International and Comparative Labor at Cornell University. Thanks, Eli, for writing this book and for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.